Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And this week, in a break from coronavirus updates, the Prime Minister instead outlined his plans to steer us all towards electric vehicles, a ban on sales of new diesel and petrol cars by 2030, a full 10 years earlier than planned. But are we ready? Do you know your BEV from your PHEV? We do some car-related jargon busting while Simon does some electric vehicle myth busting. Also today, just two easy access accounts now beat inflation and more misery is piled on to savers. Chaos at Felixstowe could cost small businesses dear and Bitcoin is back. But is it different this time? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, it's finally been confirmed. After months of speculation, the Prime Minister has announced the ban on the sale of new petrol and diesel cars would be brought forward by a decade. Now, that means we have little over 9 years to get ourselves ready. The car industry groups say it would take a Herculean effort to get us ready in time. However, your motoring correspondent, Rob Hull, thinks we shouldn't panic about the 2030 deadline. Okay, firstly, Simon. Sounds a little bit daft, but you know me, straight in there. What exactly is meant by an electric car in this context? So what is being banned? What is not? What on earth is a hybrid? What's a BEV? All these sorts of things. I don't think it's a BEV. Is it a BEV? Anyway, Rob has provided us with a jargon-busting guide, has he not?
He has. And it's not a bad question, Georgie. It's not a stupid question as to what exactly is electric in this context, because in all honesty, it wasn't entirely clear what was electric in this context in the government's announcement. It has said that all purely petrol and diesel cars will no longer be allowed to be sold new in showrooms from 2030. Now, it's important to note that that doesn't mean you have to take all the used cars, the old cars, off the roads. What was expected and what happened were two slightly different things. The bringing forward of the date has been expected for a long time. This was no surprise in any way, form or manner. Even though when the 2040 date was first mentioned, there was a lot of talk about we're going to really struggle to get there. And there was push from some sides of the car industry and a large chunk of the public saying, well, no, actually, we don't want this and we don't think this is sensible. It was always clear that that date was going to come forward. And the 2040 date was announced 3 years ago. Now we've got to 2030. 10 years is a big step. But car makers have been pushing ahead rapidly with electrification. But as you said, what kind of electrification? So you've got two different things going on. You've got pure electric cars, which run only on electricity. They have a battery. You charge up the car, and then the car is powered by energy from that battery driving the car. You don't put any petrol or diesel in it whatsoever. Then you have hybrid cars, which have the ability to drive some distance on a battery, perhaps on pure electric, and some ability to mix between electric and petrol. And I'll go into this a bit later when we talk about some of the individual cars, just some of the experience of driving them. But so, for example, you're driving around town, you're not using much power, you could be cruising along in electric mode, and then you go onto the motorway and you stick your foot down, the petrol engine kicks in. And you get plug-in hybrids, but you also get hybrid cars that charge themselves. So you don't actually plug them in at all. There was an expectation that potentially we might get a ban on everything that isn't a pure electric car. That would be the kind of nuclear option. We didn't get that. But there were thoughts that what we might get was a ban on everything that wasn't a pure electric car and plug-in hybrids that didn't do substantial distances on electric power alone. And what we actually got was a ban only on pure petrol and diesel cars. And it seems that all kinds of hybrid cars that can travel a meaningful distance will still be allowed. There's not really been any clarification on what a meaningful distance is. So there's talk about things like these mild hybrids that you get, which is just effectively a way of car makers bunging in an electric motor as well, which the car charges, and it brings down the fuel consumption. And what it's really doing for them, and what they really want to do, is it brings down carbon emissions, CO2 emissions, because they've got targets that they have to reach across their range. And so they're under a huge amount of pressure now to do it. And they've picked all the low-hanging fruit to do that. And they're now really struggling to get to reach those limits. That's why you're starting to see more and more mild hybrids rolled into cars. Whether it will remain the fact that you're still going to be able to have those after 2030 is another question, because I think that we can probably expect this to change again. The only thing I would say on that is there is going to be a considerable amount of pressure on governments not to move this stuff around too much, because controversial as it may sound in Brexit Britain, people like a concrete deadline and certainty to work towards. And the final thing I'd say on it is that this sounds like big news for us. It doesn't really matter what we do. We have a quite important car industry. We've got some very, very famous brand names in this country. We've got Jaguar, we've got Land Rover, we've got Bentley, we've got Rolls-Royce, we've got Nissan making Qashqais up in the Northeast. But in all reality, we are a relatively small car market that dances to the tune of a much bigger car market, and that is the European car market. The American car market is obviously huge, but there's still definitely a separation between America and Europe. Again, the car market, you know, a lot of Japanese and Far East car makers, Korea, for example, as well. But it's Europe that really, really matters. And Germany's got a 2030 date. France doesn't. But once France gets a 2030 date, that's it. It's 2030, basically, for the whole of the global car industry. Because the global car industry, apart from that little chunk in America that does its own thing, but is a bit more in line with Europe than it used to be decades ago, the global car industry dances to Europe's tune. And the only other tune it dances to is the Chinese tune. And China has got a massive push for electrification of cars at the moment as well anyway.
So Lee, then it begs the question, I suppose, why now? Why 10 years? I mean, I think Simon's answered why 10 years has been knocked off it, because it just seems to be what everybody else is doing. So what really practically will this mean? So say you have a diesel car too, does that mean in 2030 you've got to chuck it away?
They've got to chuck it away. But I mean, what's happening at the moment, Georgie, is that manufacturers are wising up to the fact that after the VW emissions scandal in 2015, and the fact that a previous government pushed diesel sales basically onto us, and at one point half of all cars being sold in Britain were diesel, all of that has kind of now gone completely off a cliff. And lots of major manufacturers are simply pulling diesels out of showrooms. And as Rob put in his column, it's likely by the end of next year that it's going to be very difficult to buy a brand new diesel, basically. So that is a very quick turn, isn't it? Sort of 6 years in which diesel was like, you know, seen as the thing to buy, and now seen as completely, it's been demonized. So this is part of Boris Johnson's wider picture of this green industrial revolution, a 10-point plan, which is going to, they're putting £12 billion towards it, but they're hoping for a lot more private funding. It's going to create allegedly 250,000 jobs, and this is the car part is one cog of this. Now, for me, there still remains questions, and questions that I think the British public have in their minds when it comes to electric cars. Firstly is, I don't think it's range. I don't think range anxiety is really as big a thing anymore. You know, we've seen Tesla come out with cars that can go pretty far on a single charge. And we're seeing more infrastructure coming into place. So for example, last weekend I drove past a new electric car charging forecourt, which is just in the outskirts of Braintree, and it looks like something out of space age. I mean, it really does look futuristic, and that's going to be open very soon. And that can, you know, those sort of things where you can charge a car rapidly and get to almost full battery is key for people. So at the moment it can take half an hour to get 80% battery. That's like the best performance models. If you're filling up a car with petrol, it takes 5 minutes, if that. Mm. So there's that kind of thing. And then having it charging at home is having that infrastructure of either having it on your driveway, if you have a driveway, having a charging point, and then having the local infrastructure around, you know, basically on street charging, all of that stuff needs to improve drastically, very quickly, if this target is to be realistically met. And then the impact it has on the national grid, you know, can it
cope? Explain that, Lee. What do you mean by that?
Well, you think about it. You know, you will see those stories about, you know, in the Coronation Street ad break, for example, there's a massive spike in the kettle going, you know, yes, because everyone's putting the kettle on to make a cup of tea. And, it, you know, it happens in football matches and all that kind of thing, that, you know, big matches that are being watched at home. What happens is, what happens if people start trying to charge their cars up all at the same time and it kind of overloads the national grid? We're at a point now in Britain where we are generating more of our electricity via things like the offshore wind. You know, all of that capacity needs to continue to increase, which is part of the 10-point plan. But there will be worries. I mean, no one wants to see any kind of blackouts happening. You don't want to go back to those bad old days of you know, the grid getting overloaded. Look, hopefully all of that kind of thing will grow as more people buy electric cars. And I'm sure that all of the data has been crunched because, you know, the government's pretty good at that. So hopefully, you know, they've done that, and we can kind of, you know, if there's X amount of electric cars sold in the next 5 years, what is the power solution? And also, you have to incentivize people to charge the car at certain points of the day to take pressure off the grid. So, you know, potentially parts of overnight, but that would be the ideal solution. But it costs money to get that infrastructure built into your house, you know, if you want to have it so you've got a proper rapid charging point. Again, it just costs money. And then a couple of other things, George, before you stop me, because I feel like I'm...
Wanted to ask you, what is the current adoption rate for electric cars? Just so we know exactly where we're at, because I thought it was about 3%.
That's right. Yeah, that is currently it. But the reason for that, for the reasons that I've just mentioned, I would say, there's a pricing point issue where it's quite difficult to get an electric car for under £30,000, which for the majority of people, it's just completely out of reach. Robert in his column that probably by about 2024, 2025, with improving technology and costs reducing, that it will probably, you know, be a little bit less than that. So it should become more affordable for people. That's the crux of that. And talking about things that people are kind of, I personally worry about, is batteries, the environmental impact of manufacturing batteries and what happens to these batteries once they've run the course of their life, because batteries aren't that great, you know, not easy to sort of get rid of. So to speak. So all of those things need to improve. Britain needs to have, you know, more resources thrown out of research and development into electric cars, into battery development, having factories that can make batteries instead of having to rely on perhaps China for that kind of thing. All of these things are bubbling away. You know, 2030 is quite a long way away. A lot of other countries have that target. Norway's got a target of 2025, and half of the people there already have electric cars, but that comes with a massive, you know, load of incentives that have been thrown at people. I'll leave you with one further thought on this, Georgian, and something that did make me laugh last week is basically the Department for International Trade tweeted last week, quite, you know, almost boasting, it was quite happy with this news, that a new electric Qashqai SUV was going to be built in Sunderland next year. Now, I sent this over to Rob and I was like, you know, they're kind of boasting about this. I mean, this is good news, right? So Rob sort of looked into it. It's not an electric SUV, it's a hybrid SUV. And they subsequently deleted that tweet and corrected it. But
is it because they haven't read Rob's Jargon Buster and they didn't actually
know? Well, I don't know if Rob's Jargon Buster had been quite published at that point. But it just goes to show you that, you know, even things like the Department for Trade are getting confused about electric cars, hybrid cars, mild hybrids, all of these different things. It needs to become clearer and easier for car buyers who want to make the switch. And all the things I've mentioned are things that have come into my mind. And the last thing I'll say, George, actually, as well, and again, I've mentioned this to Rob earlier, is things like lorries, like HGVs. You know, there's a consultation for HGVs diesel sales of HGVs to be gone by 2030. But that's just a consultation. And the amount of emissions that freight uses.
How long would it take to charge one of them up?
Well, exactly. And, you know, the technology in that area also needs to improve if we're to be meeting these emissions targets. So for me, you know, there's a lot of questions still, and we may get the answers in the next few years. And I'm sure we will. I'm sure technology will improve and there's a lot of innovation. I just hope some of that innovation comes, more of this innovation comes from Britain.
Indeed, indeed. Simon, I want to ask you about the infrastructure and whether we're ready, but also I liken it to the tube related contactless payment, i.e. the moment when the tubes went contactless and the buses in London. It seemed to be sort of a watershed moment. When will that come, or where will that come from with regards to electric vehicles?
The narrowing of the price point between the two of them is an important factor. So I mean, we'll go on to this in a minute, but I've been driving a selection of electric cars over the last couple of months, including some of the sort of, you know, smaller, more affordable ones, i.e. the Renault Zoe, the new Peugeot E208. But you're still talking £30,000 cars. And if you compare that to the equivalent petrol car, you're looking at them being, you know, £5,000 more expensive. And that's possibly being a little bit generous. It can often be more. Now, that's quite a lot of money, and you're going to have to drive a really, really long way before you save £5,000 on petrol. It's the cold, hard reality of it. You also need to consider, though, that it's probably going to hold its value better. It will probably remain a car that's worth more, but is that going to get eroded by more and more better cars coming out? Because the thing is, you look at a petrol car and you think, well, there'll be a new model out, obviously, and that's going to make my car depreciate a bit more. But how much more dramatically better is a petrol car going to get? Arguably not that much. With an electric car, I think people are concerned about that. But then once you start looking at how people actually buy their new cars, most people buy them on PCP deals, finance deals. So they're effectively, they're not buying the car. Then they never pay for the car outright. They're funding the depreciation. And once you start breaking it down into those monthly payments, perhaps factor in the fact that an electric car might not be forecast to depreciate as much as a petrol car, certainly not as much as a diesel car, which drop like a stone nowadays. And you find that the cost isn't that much different on a monthly basis. And then you can say to people, and how often are you filling your car up each month? If you're filling it up twice a month, it's probably costing you £120. You might only pay £30 to charge your electric car. Maybe even less than that. You might only pay £20 to charge your electric car. So you could be saving people can argue to you, you'll be saving nearly £100 a month on the cost of the fueling of the car. Then you won't be paying any road tax, so you can take that off as well. And once you start working those things out, all of a sudden you start finding that the electric car, if you're buying a brand new car on a monthly basis, starts to be not that much far off the cost of the petrol car. There is an issue, obviously, certainly for me, which is I wouldn't buy a brand new car. So you need the secondhand cars to be there. And at the moment, the secondhand electric car market is a lot better than it was. You're not just trying to buy cars off the early adopters who were few and far between, but it is still considerably smaller. And that's really the key to getting this thing going, is to make the secondhand market for electric cars work properly. And in all reality, though, that's just a bit of a supply issue. Once you start getting the wave of cars coming through in 3 years' time, when people start handing them back off their PCPs, you'll start getting more secondhand cars, and maybe it'll start to sort itself out. There is one potential game changer, though. We talked about this all the way back in February. If you can remember February, it was before the world got turned on its head. Salary sacrifice. It is possible for your employer to offer you the ability to buy an electric car through salary sacrifice. And previously, this didn't work out as well as it could have done because there was a benefit in kind charge on the electric car. So effectively, you were taxed on the perk. That was removed in April. So it's now effectively zero rated benefit in kind. And although it's going to go up, it's only going to go up to like 1% or 2%. And what that means is that you can give up the money that you would be paying monthly for the car out of your salary The company pays it directly for the car. And so you're effectively buying the car from tax-free earnings. Now, that means that if you're a basic rate taxpayer, you're saving 30%, just over 30%, because you're saving your basic rate tax and your national insurance. If you are a higher rate taxpayer, you're saving just over 40%, saving 42%, because you're saving your higher rate tax and the national insurance, which is lower above a certain level of earnings. This is looking at like the last pound that you earn kind of thing. Now, 30 or 40% off the monthly cost of buying an electric car, plus the savings on petrol, plus the savings on road tax, all of a sudden starts to look really quite attractive. And I must admit that even as a committed non-buyer of brand new cars, I would consider doing this because, you know, it really is quite a considerable saving. And that is maybe the kind of incentive rolled out, you know, across lots of different companies that could definitely change things for people. The problem with any of these incentives is once lots of people start taking them up and then people start running the numbers and going, well, this is disproportionately going to people who've got more money and everything like that, you're still going to start getting calls for it to be clamped down on as some kind of middle class professional tax break. But I mean, if you want to get a load of electric cars on the road, maybe you need some kind of middle class professional tax break. I don't know.
Oh, there's so many questions I want to ask you, but I'm starting thinking, you know, things like are electric cars, do they wear less than diesel or petrol? I mean, so they could technically last longer, so you wouldn't have as big a second-hand market. I mean, I don't know, you know, these questions. And what will we do with petrol stations?
They normally go out in a coat or a bikini. they do, generally do, actually. They do wear less, and not in the sense of clothes. There's less moving parts. If you think about an internal combustion engine, there's a lot going on in there, and there's a lot that can go wrong. In theory, an electric car is much, much simpler, has less to go wrong, and should be cheaper to service and maintain. There is an issue to do with the mechanical skills, etc., that are required, and also that if something does go wrong, it might go quite seriously wrong, and it's computer stuff that's going wrong as well. So you can't just lift the bonnet and go fix it yourself. I mean, maybe some people can. Don't do that with a car that's in warranty, by the way. But yeah, so they do wear less. You're still... People think, oh, well, it'll be great because we'll get rid of all the road noise and all of the air pollution. That's not entirely true because a lot of road noise is not engine noise. It's tire noise. And tire noise does not go away on an electric car. You also don't get rid of all of the air pollution because all of the air pollution from cars doesn't just come from what comes out the back of the car. It also comes from things like the brakes and little particles from the tyres and things like that. But they are cleaner. They are greener. They are theoretically easier to maintain. Charging it is an issue, which I wrote my column about this week because I've been running a selection of electric cars on test for review.
We'll get on to that in a few more short moments, Simon. But yeah.
Now, most people who own an electric car get themselves a home charging wall box, which means that they can plug it in at home and they can charge it. There's a £350 grant towards this from the government. Once you factor that in, the cost of a wall box is about £300 to £500. You get a 7 kilowatt wall box, you can charge your electric car in about 4 hours. The problem is that you need off-street parking. You need a drive, which not everybody has. And this gets talked about as a city problem. It's not just a city problem. It's a problem in towns and villages. I live out in Hertfordshire, in a Hertfordshire town. It's an absolute heaven of driveways and garages and detached and semi-detached houses. It's a suburban dream. I can walk you around road after road that does not have any off-street parking, though, or any garages. There's a lot of people, even in a place like this, who don't have a driveway. That means that they are entirely dependent upon public charging. And public charging infrastructure in this country is, unfortunately, woeful. It theoretically looks okay, and there's some numbers about the number of electric charge points that there are now, which compared to petrol stations, there's many, many more. But as Lee said, it takes 5 minutes just to fill a car with petrol. I don't think it even does take 5 minutes to fill a car with petrol. It actually takes about 2 to 3 minutes to fill a car with petrol. And it takes another 2 minutes to do the faffing that involves getting your car into the petrol station, stopping and doing all the other stuff.
Mm.
If you want, even with a 50 kilowatt fast charger, if you want to pretty much fully charge an electric car from nearly empty to nearly full, and the car manufacturers recommend you go to 80% because it's better for the battery than going to 100%, it's going to take you nearly an hour. So you need a lot more electric charging points than petrol pumps because in order to get people through. Now, it's fine at the moment because most people with electric cars have a wall box at home and they charge it like that. I've been running electric cars without a wall box at home. And I can tell you that if you are in that position, it's a little bit complicated. It's a bit of a faff. There's lots of different charge point companies. They've all got different apps. They've all got slightly different costs and things like that. But once you navigate your way through that, it's okay. Maybe you find your charging company that's your favorite. But there's not enough charge points. I live in a town of 30,000 people. There is effectively one public charging point. And so I think that the infrastructure is not where it needs to be at the moment. If you're going to stand up and tell people that you want people out of their petrol and diesel cars in effectively nine years' time, because we're nearly done on 2020, your infrastructure needs to be further ahead. And if you told people 3 years ago that it was going to be 2040 and everybody knew you were going to bring the date forward, you needed to make sure that you spent those 3 years getting the infrastructure ahead of where it is. I don't blame the charge point companies. I think they've done an amazing job. I blame the government. It's basically not really been doing anything. It's put out these funds for councils to use. That's very hit and miss as to whether councils have actually used them. Rob's done some investigations into this. The talk was there'd be banks of chargers in every large supermarket car park, but there isn't. There's maybe one. Why are there not banks of chargers in every large supermarket car park? Why did some ministers, surely there's someone who has some responsibility for this in the government, not go, do you know what? Actually, the supermarkets aren't doing this by themselves. We need to push this. We need to drive this forward. We need to incentivize them. The incentive would be really, really simple. I guarantee you that if you basically offered some kind of tax break to the supermarkets that basically gave them a tax break of literally just a couple of thousand pounds per year per charger, if they got chargers into their car parks, then all of a sudden you'd see a load of chargers because the chief financial officers of the supermarkets would go, well, it doesn't sound like much like per supermarket, but once you roll this up by the number of supermarkets and car parks we've got, that's a cheeky little couple of hundred thousand pounds off our tax bill. Mm-hmm. We're doing this. And you start to build up the incentive. And so I think that the charging thing, it's fine, right? It's absolutely fine. I've dealt with it fine. I've done long distances. I've driven, 4 years ago, I drove all the way to Wales and back in a Tesla. It's absolutely fine. But you really do have to plan ahead. And the early adopters and the people who are keen on it and the people who are interested are willing to plan ahead. The others aren't necessarily so. And we've got away with it so far because everybody's getting a wall box. But you can't create public policy for a nation based only on people with driveways.
Coming up, we will be talking about Savers and Felix, though. But Lee, just very briefly, 9 years feels really short amount of time. And I repeat the question that I asked you, why now? Because if the government need to do all these sort of things that Simon said, and that does seem a very sensible suggestion, many of them, they've got really quite important things to consider at the moment. Like I said, 9 years.
It's part of a climate pledge, though, isn't it? It's part of a wider thing to try and bring emissions down and bring pollution levels down. And it's a kind of global effort, as in if Britain didn't do this kind of thing, we'd look like we're lagging behind and dragging our heels. And just listening to Simon talk there, I see a car as going from point A to point B. That's all I see, a car. I'm not like a massive petrol head. I'm not hugely into cars. But to go from A to B while waiting at C in the drizzling rain for an hour and a half to kill time is not something I'd want to plan ahead and do. And I think, as Simon said, it's one of those things at the moment, it feels like you have to have a wall box in order to take advantage of this. I mean, surely if you're going to invest in an electric car, they could just throw in a wall box for this. But then that begs the question of what you do if you live in a flat and that kind of thing. I saw something about putting these charge points in existing infrastructure like lampposts. What's happened to that, Simon? Is that a thing?
Yeah, it is a thing. They've got it in Kensington, actually. Ubitricity. You sign up to an account, and they're quite slow chargers. They're 3 kilowatt chargers, but you could leave your car plugged in overnight, which is fine, actually, if you live in the area. But normal car parking charges do apply. So you need to be there after the resident parking zone finishes and after the parking charges finish. So it's not really a sort of daytime solution. But that is definitely the solution. Get them into the lamppost. Get these ones that pop up out the floor. There's lots of solutions out there. It's basically just the people in authority have not, they've been talking a big game and they're not really doing much about it. And just before we finish talking about these cars, I'll run you through a little selection.
I was gonna say, we haven't finished yet, Simon, because you're teeing that up. You've been testing out some cars recently. We've been waiting for this moment. Let's go through them, shall we? The Renault, please.
Okay, the Renault Zoe. A little bit of an unsung hero of the electric car world. Everybody thinks about the cars that brought mass market electric car ownership to the UK, Tesla and the Nissan Leaf, but actually the Zoe's been there plugging away. It's a good little car. It's just a little city car, little hatchback, plenty of room inside it, very comfortable, quite nippy to drive. With its the longest range version, has 239 miles of range. And if you choose the rapid charge option, which enables you to charge it up more quickly, it's a £31,495 car. So it's not cheap. You know, if you compare that to what you pay for a petrol Clio, you're paying quite a bit more. But we need to just set that to one side. But it's a cracking little car, to be honest. It rolls around a bit. It's like an old school hatchback, chuck it around the corners. But the thing about electric cars is they always feel faster than they actually are, because you have the power just going straight from the electric motor to the wheels. There's no gears. It's a fantastic little car. You also have regenerative braking on a lot of these cars, which means that you can push it into a mode that's usually a B, which stands for brake. And the car will slow itself down. So when you ease off the accelerator, sometimes it can be a bit lurchy. The Zoe is absolutely fine. It doesn't lurch around. There is this talk about how you can, that means you can one pedal them. You can just drive with the accelerator. Don't try and one pedal it. You'll end up in the back of the car in front of you or on top of a roundabout. But it's quite good fun to drive. A rival to that that's come out, because the Zoe sort of very much had the small electric car market to itself for quite some time. And there's some more rivals coming out. You've got a Mini coming out. But one of the best ones out is the Peugeot E208. I was driving the E208 GT. This is more of a little kind of hot hatch type car. It's not, you know, full on hot hatch like the ones that do 0-60 in 5 seconds nowadays. But it's good. And it's really good fun to drive. Again, that's a £30,000 car, 0-60 in 8 seconds, 217 mile range, 136 brake horsepower. Feels nicer inside than the Zoe. Feels a bit more grown up inside than the Zoe, but has less room in the back. And is really quite good fun to drive, actually. Corners and handles much more sportily than the Zoe. If I was going to choose between the two of them, I'd go for the E208. Then a Tesla Model 3. That's the one that's really, really popular. Tesla's been up in the top 10 selling cars list, possibly because delays of the Model 3 meant that people had to wait a long time for it, and there was a big influx of them. But if you walk around, you're starting to see a lot of Tesla Model 3s now. They were the game changer for Tesla. They were considered the game changer for the car industry because they were the more affordable version. I mean, when I say more affordable, it starts at £40,000 and it goes up to 56 and a half. The one that's the 56 and a half, though, the high performance version, is unbelievably fast. It's a car that does 0-60 in 3.1 seconds. You're talking Lamborghini quick, basically. And it's got a range of 352 miles. It's very nice inside. It's a very nice car to drive. It's an expensive car. But even if you go for the £40,500 one with Tesla, you're still getting a very, very good car. You're getting a car that's probably not going to depreciate too much as well, because people are going to want to buy them secondhand. And they're an absolute pleasure to drive. And because of the way the car is laid out, with the batteries under the floor, running along the floor, they handle very, very well. And also you benefit from Tesla's supercharger network. Tesla is basically the company that has cracked the charging thing. It's put in these superchargers all around the country. So you drive up, Tesla specific ones, big banks of them, you plug the car in, you sit there for half an hour, you go get a coffee, you've charged it to 80% and on you go. And then the other car I've driven was a plug-in hybrid. Now, this is not the kind of car that most people are going to be buying, because this is a Porsche Cayenne e-hybrid, and it costs £63,500. Okay. But what's important about this is that this is a big luxury SUV. One of the main problems that the car industry has dealt the world in recent years has been the growth in big luxury SUVs. A lot of the gains that have been made in efficiency from engines have been wiped out by people driving bigger, heavier, powerful cars. Now, arguably, you know, there are people out there who need a 4x4 and want a 4x4 and can justify the 4x4. There's a lot of people out there driving big 4x4s who don't need them. And then there's been this arms race to make them faster and faster and faster and more luxurious, which is something of a problem for the planet. Because they're really not environmentally very friendly. So if you're going to buy one of these, should you buy one with a conscience? The Porsche with a conscience, that's what the Cayenne is. It's got a plug-in hybrid system, so it's got a 3-litre V6 engine. It will do 0 to 60 in 5 seconds. It'll do top speed of nearly 160 miles an hour. It's super luxurious inside. It's a beautiful car. All Porsches are wonderful inside. But it will also do 25 to 27 miles on electric power only. Now, you can drive that in a number of different modes. You can drive it in a way that it will split the power, so it will use electric when it can, or it will use petrol when it can, or you can drive it in pure electric. So actually, you can do the school run and drive the kids to school and back only using electricity. You can drive into the city centre. You can do your out-of-town driving and your motorway driving using petrol, where the air pollution issue isn't so bad. And then when you get to the city, you can switch it to electric and you can drive around the city in electric all day long. And once the electricity runs out, the car will just switch back to petrol. And actually, I used it a few times commuting into London from home. And you could do that. And I did it where once I got to London, I switched it into electric power. And I did all of the journey in London to the office and back on electric power. And then when I was back on the motorway, you flick it back into petrol power and off you go. And that is where the real advantage of the hybrids comes in, is that if you are concerned about, you know, obviously it improves the fuel consumption and the carbon emissions and stuff like that, but they are talked up a little bit on some of the fuel economy stuff. They don't do the fuel economy that's suggested. But if you are concerned about the kind of air pollution issues and things like that, you can switch to electric power and you can just do your local journeys, do the school run, do the bits in the city on electric power, and then do the rest of it on petrol power.
There is one very, very quick question that I want to ask you. Does it feel really different? Because I think I'm the only one here who's never driven an electric car. Does it feel really different, or is it just it just feels like you're driving a car, right?
Just feels like you're driving a car. Maybe slightly different when you're first driving it. The acceleration gets a lot of people. They feel quicker than they are, and some of them are just very, very quick, like the Tesla. But no, once you start driving, the regenerative braking can take a little bit of getting used to. But once you're on the move, it's just a car. And this is the reality, is that for most people who aren't petrol heads and don't care about cars, it makes no difference whether the car they're driving is petrol, diesel, or electric. That's exactly what Lee said earlier.
Yeah.
Modern cars are designed for you to hear minimal noise inside them. Unless you are actually driving a sports car, most cars are made so that you can't hear the engine, not so that you can hear the engine.
But when you're driving a Ferrari, you want everybody else to hear it so they can see you and look at you driving.
Well, that's the thing. But you know, those are. It doesn't make any difference whether Ferraris go electric or not. It's not going to benefit the planet. Ferraris are not the problem. They don't make and sell enough of them. So for most people, it doesn't really make any difference, which is why you need to get them over these little hurdles that I was talking about, like the charging thing. And I'm not being negative about electric cars. I'm a great advocate of electric cars. As I said, for most people, it made no difference. I would happily consider our family car being electric car, no problems. I still want to keep a petrol car for fun. But, you know, that's because I am interested in cars. But for most people, it makes absolutely no difference.
And that would be the category I would put myself into. All right, we're going to move off cars and on to, I'd love to say it's something a bit cheerier, but it's not, because one day, Lee, one day we're going to have some good news for savers on this podcast. But alas, today is not that day. After a surprise bump up in inflation in October from 0.5 to 0.7%, it's still a way off from the 2% Bank of England target, but still, the number of accounts paying more than this shrunk to a massive 2%. Yeah, just two. Everyone else risks their money being eaten away by the rising cost of living if they leave it in an easy access account. Those with Britain's biggest banks could be losing £69 a year. So Lee, just let us know what's going on here. Why is inflation up and who are the two?
Well, Georgie, we could fast forward to 2030, where we finally have some good news for savers. Maybe that should be the deadline we set to give our savers some good news. There was a slight nudge in inflation last month. It was because of higher food and clothing prices, nudged up from 0.5% to 0.7%. What that means for savers is that there is an ever dwindling number of accounts in which you can put your money in to, you know, navigate what is currently really quite tricky waters in terms of getting a good return on your money. And the £69 figure that we're talking about there is if you had £10,000 of savings in a typical high street bank easy access account, which are currently pretty much paying 0.01%, which is a pound on your £10,000. We're talking about the effect of that 0.7% inflation on your money. Now, if that's you, and if you've got £10 in a savings account, or you've got £100,000 in a savings account, have a look elsewhere at what else you can get, even if it's just another easy access account that pays 0.6% or 0.7%. If we don't do this, if people continue just to leave money with the big banks, it's just going to continue. They're not going to try and get into the Best Buy savings tables whatsoever. And I know a lot of people, when we've had this conversation before, Georgie, will go, oh, but what's the point of going through all of that hassle to move the money from A to B if I'm only getting a tiny amount of interest? But unfortunately, that's the attitude a lot of people are having. And, you know, this is bleak times for savers, Georgie. It really is. And, you know, as you say, there's only two easy access accounts that are currently paying above inflation. One of those is West Bromwich Building Society. I was looking through our cash ISA tables yesterday as well at what the top rates were, and many of the top rates come with quite a lot of restrictions. So for example, they're offered by small building societies that you have to apply in branch. Now, if you don't have said building society in your area, which is probably quite likely, you can't open that account. So there's all sorts of hoops and things to also jump through at the moment. And look, if your money is languishing in savings, it might be time, depending on how much you've got, to potentially look at other options outside of savings if it suits you.
Investing, you're talking about, or?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you know, if you're going to do that and you're a novice, you know, potentially get a financial advisor or have a look at some of the This Is Money DIY investing options that we lay out, including things like stocks and shares, ISAs. But Georgia, I can't see where the situation is going to change. And I will leave you with this really, really, really bit of bad news. And that is the NS&I cuts bite in a few days' time. You know, we spoke about this a little while back. People are going to see rates absolutely crumble at NS&I, potentially for many to 0.01%. A lot of people will be thinking about, well, where do I move my money? And that is the issue. You know, I think at the moment it's almost like safety first, knowing that your money is somewhere that is safe, that has that £85,000 financial service compensation scheme protection. For NS&I, it can be higher than that, depending on what product you've got. So yeah, it's you know, it's almost like safety before rates at the moment.
As much as you might be tempted to look around elsewhere, make sure you do have that savings pot, and that's the reality. And it will be losing you probably some money, but for especially in these sort of times, you do need that easy access cash available to you.
Well, exactly. And we always say you should always have a sort of rainy day fund, you know, something that you can easily get your mitts on. And that's the thing. And that's how a lot of people do treat, you know, their savings. And lots of big
people
banks
argue you could put it in your current accounts. Perhaps they're paying interest, but
you know,
I had it in my current account. It wouldn't stay there.
That's what, yeah. So people like to have that money segregated. If you start putting it in your current account, the temptation is to spend it and to not know, you know, what it's being used for. And that is the thing, you know, and a lot of people in that boat, Georgie. It's a real tricky one at the moment. We're in real sort of choppy waters for savers at the moment, especially when it comes to those bread and butter accounts. And yeah, that's the trade-off at the moment. And it's going to be like this for quite some time, I imagine.
Talking of boats, Lee, you teed me up beautifully there, because we're going to go on to a story broken by This Is Money back in September. This is related to companies reporting delays receiving containers at Felixstowe Port. It seems the problems are continuing. It could cost British businesses thousands of pounds, even more delays. Lee, just give us an update. What was the story originally?
A really quick update on this. So a couple of months ago, George Nixon looked into this because we were receiving reports from companies saying that they were having quite severe delays in getting containers. So Felixstowe is a big, you know, container port, which a lot of international trade comes from. A lot of importers use Felixstowe to get goods from around the world. We spoke to one company in September who largely deal in Christmas goods, and they were panicking that the containers weren't showing up to then, you know, basically get the stock in and then give it to all of the retailers that buy the stock from them across the country. And it was going to be a race against the clock. Now, that same company has told us now that they've received a letter from their logistics firm. So the middleman who organises the container from the port to the business, saying that there's going to be a $1,750 surcharge per container for the foreseeable because of the issues at the port. And the issues are the containers can't get turned around quick enough, largely because of coronavirus restrictions, as in people were having to unload these almost socially distancing. There's been lorry drivers that have been furloughed or having to self-isolate, and it's had a massive knock-on effect at Felixstowe. The government is aware. Department for Transport told us before that it is monitoring the situation at Felixstowe. It's privately owned. There was also some research out suggesting basically that Felixstowe really is lagging behind other major ports across the world. So ships spend an average of 32.4 hours at Felixstowe. The average for major ports across the world is 24 hours. And the next worst is Los Angeles, which is 28.9 hours. So that's quite a big gap for turnarounds of ships. And at London and Southampton, who actually come out, they both come out quite well in this report, at 21.8 hours for London and 22.9 hours for Southampton. It just shows you how much longer, almost half a day longer currently stuck at Felixstowe Port for boats sitting there. And I haven't mentioned the name, we haven't mentioned the name of any of this company in the report because they don't want to rock the boat. Sorry to put that to you, because you know they don't want to you know, lose their logistics firm or, you know, get banned from the port or any of that. But there seems to be all sorts of problems bubbling away there, Georgie. And if companies already stretched, already struggling, are now going to have to pay extra unforeseeable costs to receive containers, that's not good news in a time in which small businesses are majorly struggling. And we'll keep monitoring the situation there. George will keep monitoring the situation. If you are someone that's been affected or know someone that's been affected, please do contact us, editor@thisismoney.co.uk.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. And finally, taxi drivers, hairdressers, they'd be talking to us about it. That's if we could go anywhere. But I am talking about Bitcoin. It's back. But Simon, is it here to stay? Is it different this time?
It's always different this time, yeah. Georgie. It's always different this time. So all of those who hodled last time around held on for dear life. Many people, actually, who bought, even if they bought near the peak of the Bitcoin boom, when it knocked on the door of $20,000, will finally be either level or potentially slightly up on where they were. And anybody who bought when it was cheaper than that is probably looking at it and thinking, oh, I've done quite well here. Yes, Bitcoin has been on another run. We discussed this a few weeks back. It was 3 years ago it went on its major run, I believe. And we watched the price of Bitcoin just rise pretty much in a straight line up into the air as everybody went absolutely crypto crazy. And it wasn't just Bitcoin, it was Ethereum and Ripple and every other coin that you could think of that people were talking about, and how this one was actually better than that one, and it wouldn't be Bitcoin. Everybody talks about Bitcoin, but actually Ethereum is better, or Ripple's better, or whatever kind of thing. And then it all fell off a cliff. And Bitcoin has been on the rise again. It actually is slightly different this time, in that there is a lot more of the what would be termed traditional financial industry interested in Bitcoin. We even had the Bank of England putting out stuff about, you know, cryptocurrency and stuff the other day, talking about creating a digital currency. What Bitcoin has managed to do, I think, is the thing that people are, well, not what Bitcoin has managed to do, what Bitcoin has started to manage to do is the thing that people said it would do and why it was going to be the new gold. It has sort of establishing itself as a consistent store of value. However, I mean, you have to put that in the context of something that is wildly volatile, and a consistent store of value doesn't really want to be wildly volatile. Obviously, the gold price also tends to move around quite a lot, but gold has thousands of years of proof as a store of value, and so you can let it off a bit of, you know, heavy volatility as it's traded on sentiment. Bitcoin, well, who knows if it will be here in a couple of thousand years? I don't know, but it's in limited supply. And of all the cryptocurrencies, it is probably the one where people go, okay, I'll put some money into Bitcoin. And I think, you know, that's the most solid of the cryptocurrencies. Mm-hmm. You've got some of the institutional investors putting money in. You've got some of the big, you know, financial companies. Jack Dorsey of Twitter said he was going to stick a load of money in. You've got more solid interest now than just people hoping and trading and buying it in their bedroom and all that kind of stuff. I mean, who knows what happens next? Will it surpass its peak? If it surpasses its peak, what happens then? Does it keep going up? Or does it just come crashing straight back down to earth? I can definitely see a scenario where it knocks on the door of that peak, doesn't make it, and then just absolutely nosedives again. Or I can see a scenario where it goes up and goes through it. I mean, the one thing I would say to anybody considering buying any form of cryptocurrency or Bitcoin or anything, Tesla shares, anything that has a tendency to be kind of wildly volatile, is don't put all your eggs in one basket. Diversify. Okay, I've got some money in Bitcoin. I put some money in Bitcoin after it crashed after the peak last time round, and for a long period of the 3 years since, the money that I put in Bitcoin has been down. At times it's been up. Often when me and Lee had a conversation about it, and then I checked the eToro account that I've got it in, and looked at it, and it was slightly up and said it, the price then promptly crashed and I'd end up down again. Now, it's worth nearly twice as much as I put in, and I didn't put much money in, okay? Mm. Just to be clear. But it's only a small amount of the money that I have invested in investment accounts, and I have rainy day savings and stuff like that. The worry is people lumping tons and tons of money into this, chasing gains, and that's what happened last time around. I mean, last time around we had credit card companies saying people were no longer going to be allowed to buy it on their credit card, which was just red flag central. So, I mean, I think it's more a bit of fun than a proper financial instrument, but it's starting to look like it's making its way in the world as a little bit of a proper financial instrument.
I was really surprised to find out the other half had some money invested in Bitcoin. I was like, goodness me, your quid's in. He's like, yeah. £45. That's how much you invest in Bitcoin. Yeah. Yeah. We're rich. No, we're not. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcasts to join in the debate. You can read the comments and see all podcasts past.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.